back to Inside Personal Growth. This is Greg Voisin, the host of your podcast. And I want to thank all of our listeners for coming back again and again and again, listening to all this inspirational material from our authors. And today on the line, I have Simon Sinek with me, and his new book is called Start With Why, How Great Leaders Inspire Everyone to Take Action. And good day to you, Simon. It's a pleasure having you on the podcast with us today.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
We appreciate the opportunity to interview you. What I always like to do, Simon, is tell our listeners a little bit about you. Simon teaches leaders and companies to inspire people. He created a simple model called the Golden Circle that codifies what makes the most inspiring people and organizations so successful. The concept is so powerful that it is changing the way people think and act. Simon has been invited to talk about the Golden Circle across the United States and around the world, from members of Congress to foreign ambassadors to small businesses to corporations like Microsoft, from Hollywood to the Pentagon. More and more people are learning to become more effective, more efficient, and more inspired by discovering the power of why and following their Golden Circle. The book we're going to be talking about today, again, is called Start With Why. And, you know, Simon, right off the bat, the premise behind your book is really in asking the right questions, and primarily the question of why. So what I think our listeners might want to know is, why is it that you believe why is so important to someone in business or just anyone wanting to gain clarity in their life?
Well, what I learned was is that there's a natural pattern that exists in all organizations or people's careers. And it's based on three ideas. It's what you do, how you do it, and why you do it. And, you know, everybody knows what they do, and every company knows what they do. Some know how they do it, whether you call it your differentiating value proposition or your proprietary process. But very, very few people or organizations can clearly say why they do what they do. And by why, I don't mean to make money. That's a result. That's always a result. By why, I mean what's your purpose, what's your cause, what's your belief. And what I found astounding is that most every business, every organization, and every career functions on all these three levels. And the problem is most organizations, most people are only even aware that two of those pieces exist. In other words, we obsess about what we do, and we obsess about how we do it. We're all about trying to, you know, set goals and figure out how we're going to achieve them. And that means that if you're only obsessing about two pieces of a three-piece puzzle, inherently, most organizations are going to be out of balance. And I can always tell when an organization is out of balance, when they know what they do, they know how they do it, but they don't know why, because they become obsessed with their competition. They struggle to differentiate. There's increased stress to go to work every day, and maybe an obsession with price. These are symptoms of an organization that knows what they do, knows how they do it, know why they do it. And so once I discovered this three-piece puzzle, I became absolutely obsessed with my own why and where it exists in the outside world.
Well, let me ask you this. What are some of the companies that you have found that the leaders with inside those companies have asked the question why and would actually be good places for people to work?
Well, most of the businesses that we like to do business with, quite frankly, have a clear sense of why, whether it's Apple Computers or Harley-Davidson or Southwest Airlines or Patagonia and, you know, Whole Foods. These organizations, if there's clarity inside the company of why everybody comes to work every day, then the odds are very high that there's going to be clarity outside the company of why people do business with you. You know, if the people inside don't understand why you do what you do, then the people outside will never understand it. So it's usually pretty easy to see when a why is clear inside the company, because we get it. And that's how we describe it. We get it, you know, and we have cultish loyalty to some of these companies. And so that's how you can tell. It's not mysterious.
Well, so,
and so the leaders of those organizations, the ones that you want to turn to and find out why they started their businesses.
So there's an essence there, and there's this kind of DNA that really rides with these companies that makes them so successful. Companies like Patagonia, these kind of companies that really the founders of those companies have put within the culture of the organization an essence which permeates all the way through not only the people, but the products they sell. Is that correct?
It's exactly right. And they don't define themselves by the products they make. They define themselves by this higher sense of purpose or cause or belief. You know, Apple doesn't define itself as a computer company. They define themselves as a company that wants to challenge the status quo and empower the individual. And it's this sense of higher purpose that allows them the freedom and the flexibility to sell other products like MP3 players and phones and DVRs. You know, Apple's just a computer company. They have equal and open access to the same consultants, the same talent, the same agencies, the same media as everybody else. Then why is it that when Dell came out with an MP3 player, nobody bought one? We couldn't imagine buying an MP3 player from Dell because they've defined themselves as a computer company. So that's all they'll ever make. And so these leaders that use their companies to try and communicate or advance some personal cause, some ideal, are really the ones that are doing it differently, that start with why. And the results are self-evident. You know, we refer to these companies as the exceptions. We study the ones who do the, you know, we study the majority and say the majority works, and we just refer to these as the exceptions. Ah, but that's the exception. Well, let's study the exceptions and understand why they're the exceptions.
Well, that's a great way to put it. Now, really early in your book, when it comes down to leaders, you make a comparison about Samuel Langley, who was really well-funded in his efforts by the government to create the first flying machine. And you also compare Wilbur and Orville Wright, who had no funding yet, but were able to become the first to create a successful flying machine. So my question for you and to the listeners is, why, in your estimation, did the Wright brothers succeed and Samuel Langley not succeed at this, and what were the differences between these inspired leaders, as you call them?
It's a remarkable comparison. If you think about, or if you ask any company that either failed or had a failed product, and you ask them, you know, why did it fail, they'll usually give you the same two or three reasons, which is it was they were underfunded, didn't have enough money, you know, undercapitalized, they had the wrong people, they had bad market conditions, and these are the reasons you get, right? Sort of these are the normal reasons you get. And so if you study closely the comparison between Langley and the Wright brothers, you see that Langley actually had what we consider the recipe for success. Way back in the early 20th century, the pursuit to be the first in flight was not you know, only between these two teams. It was like the dot-com of the day. Lots and lots of people were trying it. But Samuel Pierpont Langley was the forerunner. He was considered the favorite. And he had what we consider the recipe for success. The precursor to the Defense Department, they funded Langley. They gave him $50,000 to come up with this flying machine, right? So he was very well capitalized. He hired the best brains that he could find of the day. The best engineers, the best. The dream team. So he had talent. He had the best people. The market conditions for him were fantastic. The New York Times followed him around everywhere. Everybody knew who he was, and everyone was rooting for Langley. What's more, Langley worked at Harvard, worked at the Smithsonian and held a seat at Harvard, and was very well connected to some of the big business minds and politicians of the day. So Langley had everything going for him, except one huge thing. Langley wasn't motivated by why. Langley was motivated by what. Langley was trying to be the first in flight because he wanted to be rich and he wanted to be famous. He envied people like Thomas Edison, and he thought that the flying machine could be his ticket to fame and fortune. A few hundred miles away in Dayton, Ohio, you had Orville and Wilbur Wright. Orville and Wilbur Wright had none of the recipe for success. Not a single person on the Wright brothers' team had a college education, not even Orville or Wilbur. Some of them didn't even have high school educations. They were not funded by anybody. They paid for their dream with the proceeds from their bicycle shop. They weren't well connected, and the New York Times followed them around nowhere. Nobody even knew who they were. The difference was they had a dream. They believed that if they could invent this flying machine, it would change the course of the world. And that's what drove them every day. They had this sense of purpose and cause. And all those who joined their team believed what they believe. And I always say, people who believe what you believe will work for you with blood and sweat and tears, and people who don't believe what you believe will work for your money. And they tell stories of how when the Wright brothers would take test flights. They would take 5 sets of parts every time they went out, because that's how many times they would crash before they came in with supper. And the only way people go back failure after failure after failure is because they believe they're working on something that has a higher sense of purpose and cause and belief. And lo and behold, on December 17th, 1903, the Wright brothers took flight. And nobody was even there to witness it except their team. The world found out about it a few days later.
Interesting.
And further proof that Langley was motivated by the wrong thing. Again, Langley was doing it not because he had a higher sense of purpose or cause. Langley had no why. Langley wanted to get rich and famous. That's why he was doing it. That he was motivated by the result, not by the cause. And further proof that Langley was motivated by what was as soon as he found out that the Wright brothers had been the first in flight, he quit. He got out of the game.
Mm-hmm.
He could have said, nice job, guys. Now I will improve upon your technology. You know, many, many examples of the second or third guy. You know, Southwest Airlines didn't invent low-cost airlines. Pacific Southwest did. Southwest improved upon it. Apple didn't invent the multi-gigabyte MP3 player. Creative in Singapore did. Apple improved upon it. So there's tons of examples where the first to market doesn't actually achieve the fame. Now, granted, this was a little different in terms of the fact that it was a major monumental experience in life. However, Langley could have gone on to improve upon the technology and gain fame that way, but he didn't. He quit.
Mm-hmm.
He
mm-hmm.
didn't get rich. He didn't get famous. He got out of the game, and the Wright brothers went on to improve upon their own technology.
So he was in it for the wrong reason. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but there's a third mix in this equation. And his name is Gabriel Voisin, and he's from France. And actually, it's purported, now this is in U.S. history, that our U.S. history's books say that Wilbur and Orville Wright were the first to fly. But the reality is, from a timeline standpoint, who this is my great-great-grandfather, by the way, Gabriel Voisin, V-O-I-S-O-N, was the one, or V-O-I-S-I-N, was the first one to actually fly a plane. It's pretty interesting history. I don't know if you're aware of that or not, but that is a purported truth. It's not in our history books because he was
right.
a Frenchman, but it's a very interesting story to say the least.
Like we like to think that Henry Ford invented the car, which he didn't.
Right.
It was Benz that invented the car. Henry Ford invented the ability to make them en masse.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, you make the point, you state a point that our behavior is affected by our assumptions or our perceived truths. So why is it so important for our listeners out there to understand how they can change these perceived truths, and why will that make them better leaders, whether it be in their home life or whether it be at work?
Well, I mean, you hit on perhaps one of the most profound statements, I think, in our own lives, which is the perceived truths or assumptions we have govern our behaviors. But the question is, what if those assumptions are false? You know, not too long ago, people thought the world was flat. That was the perceived truth. And it changed the behavior of the entire population of the world. There was very little exploration in those days. And it wasn't until that one minor little detail that the world is actually round did it change everyone's behavior. And all of a sudden, you know, people started traveling. They were afraid if they traveled when they thought the world was flat, because they thought if they traveled too far, they'd fall off the end, you see. And so they just didn't travel. But once they realized the world was round, then all of a sudden, you know, exploration became robust and trade routes were established and the spread of mathematics and science, et cetera, and it changed the world. This simple false assumption changed the world. And so when you ask people in business, you know, why do customers buy from you? You know, everybody thinks it's price or quality or service or features, right? But these are just assumptions. Says who? There's not a single product or service available in the market today, in B2B or B2C, I don't care, that people can't buy from somebody else for about the same price, about the same service, about the same quality, about the same features. And if you have a first mover's advantage, that's probably going to be lost in a few months anyway. But when you ask most companies, why are your customers, they always say it's our service, it's our quality, it's our features, right? In other words, most companies have no clue why their customers are their customers. And so the question is, if you don't know why your customers are your customers, then what do you do or how do you act to attract new ones or keep the ones you have? Well, there's only two ways to influence human behavior. You can either manipulate it or you can inspire it. That's it. And examples of manipulation in business are things like dropping your price, having a promotion, 2-for-1, free toy inside. Fear is a wonderful manipulator. Peer pressure, you know, 4 to 5 dentists, celebrity endorsements. These are all examples of peer pressure. And these are the tactics and strategies that most companies use because they work. The problem is they're based on false assumptions. They believe that people buy because they want the highest service, the highest quality, the highest features. But if you look at the companies that command the greatest loyalty, the highest profitability, the greater innovation than everybody else, those companies that we talked about, what you find is they're almost rarely the cheapest. Their quality is debatable. It's not. They have some fantastic quality products. They have some that aren't. Their systems aren't perfect, and their service isn't always great. I mean, there was a long time for Harley Davidson. If you wanted to buy a custom Harley, you waited 6 months to get it. That's bad service. But people rationalize it away or put up with it, not because the product is necessarily better. It's because they believe in something, and they see this product and the service or this company as proof of who they see themselves as. In other words, it's self-fulfilling. People who see themselves as thinking different and wanting to challenge the status quo, they love Apple computers. It's an emblem of who they are. Mm-hmm. That's why when you try and tell them, hey, do you realize you bought a doubly priced substandard computer? The reason they get so mad and start foaming at the mouth is not because you insulted the computer, it's because you insulted them. And this is the clearer an organization, the clearer a company can be about what they believe and why they exist, then the more likely that people will engage with those products, engage with those brands, engage with those services, not necessarily because they're better, but because they have this visceral connection to that cause. And then the products become the tangible manifestation of it.
That's incredible advice for the listeners. But the other thing I wanted to mention was, you know, you tell a great story, and I think it goes right in line with what you're saying about Dr. Seuss. And you use this Dr. Seuss story and the Sneetchers, is it, as a way, as a way to understand our need as human beings for belonging.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
You mentioned that it's biological, right? And I know we're all out there saying, okay, it's biological, it's a need. If I'm an Apple user, I want to use an Apple because I belong to this cool group of people.
Right.
So why, as a leader, is it so important for us to understand this biological urge and need for belonging, as was depicted by Dr. Seuss in what you have in one of the chapters in the book?
Yeah, the Dr. Seuss example of the Sneetches I used was, for those who don't know the story of the Sneetches, there's these two animals, the Sneetch, and one have stars on their bellies and one don't. And the ones with stars on their bellies tell everybody that they're better because they have stars on their bellies. And so all the ones with stars that don't have stars on their bellies pay to have stars put on their bellies so they can feel like they belong to the elite group. And it's just a metaphor that the most basic human desire is to feel like you belong. You know, this is why we join clubs. This is why we like sports teams. This is why we create neighborhoods. It's a basic human need and desire to feel like you belong. Because when you feel like you belong to something, what is the feeling of belonging, right? Belonging is when you have a common set of values and beliefs as somebody. You know, the human race is successful not because we're the strongest. It's not even because we're the smartest. It's because we're social animals and we have the ability to form cultures. What's a culture? What's a community? It's a group of people with a common set of values and beliefs. What's a company? It's a group of people with a common set of values and beliefs, right? Do you think people are motivated to come to work because of the products you make? No. It's because of the culture. It's the people they work with. It's the feeling they get when they come to work. And never did I came up with this most profound example. I realized this most profound example as I was writing the book. Imagine there's a couple, husband and wife, and they want to go out on a date, and they need a babysitter for their child. And they have two options, right? The first option is a 16-year-old girl from the neighborhood who has no babysitting experience. The second option is a 32-year-old who's just moved into the neighborhood, we don't know where from, and has 10 years of babysitting experience. Who do you hire to look after your most valued possession on the planet? You hire the 16-year-old. In other words, we would rather trust our most valued possession on the planet, our children, to someone who we know shares our values and beliefs because they come from our community, even though they have no experience, over somebody with 10 years experience but we don't know what their values and beliefs are. Then why do we do it differently at work? Why are we obsessed with people's resumes and what they've done in the world, but we never find out if they're a good fit for our culture, if they believe what we believe? The only way to find that out is if we know what we believe and we talk about why we do what we do. Because if people can't see it and feel it, they can't be attracted to it. You want to know what happened at Lehman Brothers? Lehman Brothers was very good at what they did. Lehman Brothers was excellent at how they did it. But nobody knew why Lehman Brothers existed beyond making money. In other words, there was no culture And when there's no culture, there's no trust. And if there's no trust, then nobody will look out for the organization or the good of the community. They will only look out for themselves. And at the slightest shimmy, it will collapse. It's like sitting on a chair that only has three legs. If you're sitting at the perfectly right angle, you know, that chair works perfectly. Even if somebody from the outside says, I think your chair is not very stable, you're saying, what do you mean? It's working fine. In other words, if the market conditions happen to be perfect for what you're doing, there's no problem. However, if you lean forward, that chair will collapse. In other words, at the slightest change in the market conditions, if they're not perfectly suited to exactly how things are going, it will collapse because there's no strength of culture, there's no sense of why, there's no purpose or belief. People will work hard to keep the company strong, not necessarily because they care about the company, it's because they care about themselves, and mm-hmm. they care about their colleagues. And the more trust that exists in an organization, the stronger an organization is, the harder people work, the more productive you are, the more profitable you are, the more innovative you are, for no other reason than people believe. Mm-hmm. They come to work and they believe.
Yeah, and it's such an important message. Now, you mentioned that there are few leaders that choose to inspire, but rather they choose to manipulate. And you mentioned that those who inspire utilize what's called a naturally occurring pattern called the golden circle. And what I'd like you to do for our listeners is explain this and how we can apply that concept of this golden circle to our lives and why it's so important.
Sure. The golden circle is the name I gave to this natural pattern that exists in the world that I talked about before, why, how, and what. And if you imagine a bullseye, and in the bullseye in the center is the word why, and beneath that in the middle ring is the word how, and in the outside ring is the word what. That's the golden circle, why, how, what. And as we said before, everybody knows what they do. Some people know how they do it, but most cannot clearly articulate why they do what they do, that purpose, that cause, or belief, right? And so that's the golden circle. And the most inspiring leaders and the most inspiring organizations know why they do what they do, but most importantly, they think, act, and communicate from the inside out of that golden circle. They always start with why. And it's this naturally occurring pattern that really distinguishes the most inspiring leaders and organizations, everything from Apple computers to Martin Luther King. They think, they act, they communicate the exact same way. So an example I like to use, because it's easy to understand that everybody gets, is Apple. And it's a simple marketing example. If Apple were like everyone else, a marketing message from them, for example, might sound like this. They would start with what they do. We make great computers, right? How do they do it? They're beautifully designed, simple to use, and user-friendly. Want to buy one? Big deal, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But that's how most companies communicate. Here's our new car. It's got tinted windows, great gas mileage, leather seats. Buy it. Here's our law firm. We've got all the best lawyers. They went to all the best schools. We win all of our cases. Do business with us. What most people in the companies do is they tell you what they do, they tell you how they're different or how they're better, and try and give you the reason why you should do business with them, and they expect some sort of behavior, usually a purchase, right? But it could be a politician looking for a vote, could be anything like that. However, the inspired leaders, the inspired organizations, all think, act, and communicate the completely opposite way. So here's how Apple actually does it. They start with why. Their marketing sounds something like this. Everything we do, we believe in challenging the status quo. We believe in thinking differently. The way we challenge the status quo is by making our products beautifully designed, simple to use, and user-friendly. We just happen to make great computers. Mm-hmm. Want to buy one?
Mm-hmm.
It's a totally different experience now. I didn't change any of the reasons. I didn't change any of those hows. I didn't change any of those differentiating value propositions. All I did was reverse the order of the information. I started with why. And you realize that it's not what we do that matters, it's why we do it. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And those that understand and have the clarity of why are the ones that are capable of inspiring people to do business with them.
Toyota's a great example of that too. And I think, as you talked about Apple, obviously, I think 100 million iPods being sold. And obviously, that is a huge success and a turning point for a company like that. Same thing with the Prius for Toyota and how they communicate.
Million,
go ahead.
And it's 100 million. It's 100 million iPods.
Yep.
Where they're plagued with battery problems. Remember, there's all that controversy about the batteries dying early and you can't change it.
Right.
And they didn't invent the product. They were 2 years late to the market. Right. Created out of Singapore. Actually came up with the multi-gigabyte MP3 player, so Apple was 2 years late, and we don't even know if it's a better product because nobody's ever tried anything else. Mm-hmm. It's just such the dominant brand.
Right.
And so you can say it's better, but who's tried any of the others, you know? Well, nobody sat down and done a comparison to all the multi-gigabyte MP3 players in the market. We don't even know.
Right. Because you believe in the why of the company. So, you know, that leads me to a question here about you compare and contrast two leaders at Microsoft, Bill Gates and Steve Ballmer. And obviously these are both great leaders. So why are these two leaders so different, and what makes them inspirational in their own way?
Well, I don't know. Bill Gates is indeed a great leader. He's charismatic and he's inspiring. And the funny thing is, he's not the greatest public speaker and he's socially awkward, but his charisma. What is the definition of charisma? Charisma is not energy. Charisma is not coming in and screaming and yelling and, you know, jumping up and down. That's energy. Charisma is this undying belief in what you do, this unwavering optimism, you know. And Bill Gates has this unbelievable optimism. The future is good, and the future is bright. And his cause is to help people be more productive so they can achieve their greatest potential. Now, his first big success. I mean, look, he was doing this before Microsoft. He was tinkering around with traffic lights in Seattle to help people get to work quicker. In other words, so they could be more productive. And Microsoft, the whole point of Microsoft, the reason why Microsoft was founded, was to help people take advantage of this amazing new technology called personal computing. And this new technology could help people be more productive so they could achieve their greatest potential. Now he's moved on to the Gates Foundation, and if you listen to him when he talks about the Gates Foundation, although he's no longer talking about personal computing, he's talking about potential, and he's talking about productivity. It's the same cause, it's just a different product. And so Gates truly is inspiring, and he wouldn't have been able to build that organization the size it became if it weren't for scores of people who believe what he believed and committed with blood, sweat, and tears to help him build it. Ballmer, who is absolutely one of those believers from the beginning and helped Bill Gates build the company, is not the same kind of leader. He has a lot of energy, but he doesn't seem to have that same inspirational quality as Gates. And, you know, we don't know what Ballmer believes. He has the capacity to be inspiring. Every person has the capacity to inspire. This is the whole point of the book that I wrote, which is this: even though some people have the natural they were born with the ability to inspire, what I learned is that this pattern, you know, understanding your golden circle, can be learned. In other words, the ability to inspire and great leadership can be learned. So that's not to say that Ballmer doesn't have the ability. It's that we don't know what he believes. What does Steve Ballmer believe? Mm-hmm. What is he trying to achieve in the world? We don't know. We have no clue. And so when he comes out on a stage and he gives a great performance and he's got great energy, the question is, does he leave you inspired when he leaves the room?
Or does
you go and do
or does he leave
yourself?
It empty? Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
No, get what you're saying. Now, I have a question, though. But you think about the difference here between your comparison and contrasting. Do you find look at working with leaders that those that were willing, like Orville Wright, to do everything at any cost to make whatever happen? In other words, take those huge risks like Bill Gates and like the Wright brothers, those questions that you had, versus those like Steve Ballmer, who really kind of came in and I kind of call rode on the shirt tails of the gain of the company. There's a big difference between those entrepreneurs who are actually out there and hit it at the hard line and willing to take that, who have that kind of, as I call it, DNA, that inspiration, that commitment to want to go further than anybody else. Do you find that so, Simon?
You know, I think it's what we do in our society is unfair, which is we tend to judge leadership as a single line. You know, we believe that the CEO comes at the top, and we celebrate visionaries, as we call them, whether it's the Walt Disneys of the world, the Steve Jobses of the world, or the Bill Gateses of the world. You know, we call them visionary, and we celebrate them, and we consider them the top. But in reality, it's really two parallel lines. You have the how types and you have the why types. The how types in the world are people, and most people in the world are how types. These are people who can build structures, they can get their jobs done, they know what to do, they know how to do it, and they can see the world around them. They function very well in reality. And how types can do extremely well in the world, they make a lot of money, they can be very successful and build successful companies. They'll never build billion-dollar businesses, and they'll never change the world, right? Why guys have to get at the short end of the stick? Because why guys are the ones who could build billion-dollar businesses or change the world if only they knew how. And the reason we call the Y guys visionaries is because they actually look, we call them visionary because they can see things. They can see beyond the world that we can see. And the great, and there's this inextricable link between communication and leadership. You know, great leaders are the ones who can clearly communicate the thing that they can see. And those who can clearly communicate the things that they can see are the great leaders. Because all the great leaders, Martin Luther King, Ronald Reagan, they could all talk about the future, and they could talk about it clearly. And however, you know, as I said before, a Y guy can change the world if only he knew how. They might have the vision, but it's the ability to build a structure that stymies them. And so what really makes great organizations happen is never one person. It's mm-hmm. two people.
Right.
It's always two people. It's right. the guy with the vision and the person who believes what they believe and knows how to build it and works alongside of them. And it's that CFO or COO, usually in the corporate structure, which, by the way, you know, any CFO or COO who's really good at their job and thinks that they're in line for the CEO, it's a different skill set. It's a parallel line, not a single line, and you need both. You need the person who can see beyond the trees, and you need the person who knows how to get everybody through the forest.
Well, I
and
think
you those people operate together. It's amazing.
It is amazing, and you've articulated that so well for our listeners. I think for them to understand the differences in leadership between the how and the why people. And can you let our listeners know, because this is really a great book, where they can find out more about the book, your website, any information about you, and the Start With Why book, how great leaders inspire everyone to take action?
Sure. They can go to startwithwhy.com, startwithwhy.com, which is my website, which has some insight about the book, has a free chapter to download, and more about me and the work that I do. In addition, we have a Y University on the website so that people who want to learn their why can go through an online self-guided course and actually learn their why as well. In addition, if people want to read about the things that I'm doing and the things that I'm seeing in the world, I have a blog, which is just my name, simonsinek.com. You can link to it from the other website as well, but simonsinek.com. And I write about the companies that I see or the trends that I learn about that truly captivate and capture this essence of why. And, of course, the book is available at Borders and Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com and other fine bookstores.
Well, Simon, it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast with us today. And I just want to acknowledge you for being inspiring in your own right about letting people know how important it is to really come from purpose and to drive not only themselves, but the organizations in which they're part of and which they're part of the total of, to really say, live your purpose, live your promise, be inspired. You truly are inspiring. You did a great job on this book. I want to acknowledge you for it, and I want to encourage all of our listeners to take a minute to go to Simon's website and to check him out. And obviously, if you have interest, please pick up the book, read it. It's a great read. Simon, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it. We always appreciate having
you.
Luminary leaders on the line with us.
Thank you.
So
and
much.
All I ask is one favor, which is if you do get the book and if it inspires you, please pass it on to somebody else. Because the more people that learn about the why, I promise you we can change this world.
I so agree with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very, very much.